Chapter 27. Bavaria, Germany, March 1938. Her cottage in Vogel's secret village is flimsy and draughty, the coldest place she has ever known. There is a fireplace, though, and in the afternoon, while she studies codes and radio procedures, an Abwehr man comes and lays kindling and dry fir logs for the night. The fire has burned low. The cold is creeping into the cottage, so she rises and tosses a pair of large logs onto the embers. Vogel is lying on the floor silently behind her. He is a terrible lover, boring, selfish, all elbows and knees. Even when he tries to please her, he is clumsy and rough and preoccupied. It is a wonder she has been able to seduce him at all. She has her reasons. If he falls in love with her, or becomes obsessed with her, Vogel will be reluctant to send her to England. It seems to be working. When he was inside her a moment ago, he professed love for her. Now, as he lies on the rug, staring at the ceiling, he seems to be regretting his words.
"Sometimes I don't want you to go," he says.
"Go where?"
"To England."
She comes back, lies down next to him on the rug, and kisses him. His breath is horrible. Cigarettes, coffee, bad teeth.
"Poor Vogel. I've made a shambles of your heart, haven't I?"
"Yes, I think so. Sometimes I think about taking you back to Berlin with me. I can get you a flat there."
"That would be lovely," she says. But she is thinking it might be better to be arrested by MI5 than spend the war as Kurt Vogel's mistress in some hovel of a flat in Berlin.
"But you are far too valuable to Germany to spend the war in Berlin. You must go behind enemy lines to England."
He pauses and lights a cigarette.
"And then there's something else, I think. I think, why would a beautiful woman fall in love with a man such as myself? And then I have my answer. She thinks he won't send her to England if he loves her."
"I'm not clever or cunning enough to do something like that."
"Of course you are. That's why I chose you."
She feels anger rising within her.
"But I've enjoyed our time together. Emilio said you were very good in bed. The best fuck of my entire fucking life. That's the way Emilio described it. But then Emilio tends to be a bit of a vulgarian. He said you were better than even the most expensive whores. He said he wanted to keep you in Spain as his mistress. I had to pay twice his usual fee. But believe me, you are well worth the money."
She gets to her feet.
"Get out of here now. I'm leaving in the morning. I've had enough of this hellhole."
"Oh, yes, you're leaving in the morning. But it's not where you think. There's just one problem. Your trainers tell me that you are still reluctant to kill with your knife. They say you shoot very well, better than the boys even. But they say you are slow with your stiletto."
She says nothing, just glares at him, lying on the rug in the firelight.
"I have a suggestion for you. Whenever you must use your stiletto, think of the man who hurt you when you were a little girl."
Her mouth drops open in horror. She has told only one person about it in her entire life, Maria. But Maria must have told Emilio, and Emilio, the bastard, told Vogel.
"I don't know what you're talking about," she says, but there is no conviction to her words.
"Of course you do. It's what made you what you are, a heartless fucking bitch."
She reacts instinctively. She takes a step forward and kicks him viciously beneath his chin. His head snaps back and crashes violently against the floor. He's very still, perhaps unconscious. Her stiletto is on the floor next to the fire. They have trained her to keep it near at all times. She picks it up and presses the release, and the shiny blade snaps into place. In the firelight, it is blood red. She takes a step toward Vogel. She wants to kill him, to plunge the stiletto into one of the kill zones they have taught her, the heart, the kidneys, through the ear or the eye. But Vogel is leaning on one elbow now, and there is a gun in his hand aimed at her head.
"Very good,"
he says. Blood is pouring from his mouth.
I think you are ready now. Put away the knife and sit down. We need to talk. And please put on some clothes. You look ridiculous standing there like that.
She puts on a robe and stirs the embers while he dresses and tends to his mouth.
You're a complete bastard. I'd be a fool to work for you, Fogel.
Don't even think of trying to back out now. I'd provide the Gestapo very convincing evidence of your father's treachery against the Führer. You wouldn't want to see the things they do to people like that. And if you ever cross me once you're in England, I'll deliver you to the British on a silver platter. If you think that fellow hurt you when you were a little girl, just think about being raped repeatedly by a bunch of stinking British guards. You'll be their favorite prisoner, believe me. I doubt they would ever bother to hang you.
She has gone very still in the dark. She thinks how she can smash his skull with a cast-iron poker, but Fogel is still holding his gun. She realizes she has been manipulated by him. She thought she was deceiving him. She thought she was in control. But all the while, it was Fogel. He was trying to instill in her the ability to kill. She realizes he has done a very good job indeed. Fogel is talking again.
By the way, I killed you tonight while you were letting me fuck you. Anna Katharina von Steiner, age 27, died in an unfortunate road accident outside Berlin about an hour ago. A terrible pity. Such a waste of talent.
Fogel is dressed now, holding a wet cloth against his mouth. It is stained with his blood.
You're going to Holland in the morning, just as we planned. You stay there for 6 months, firmly establish your identity. Then you go to England. Here are your papers for Holland, your money and your train ticket. I have people in Amsterdam who will contact you and guide you from there.
He comes forward and stands very close to her.
Anna wasted her life, but Catherine Blake can do great things.
She hears the door close behind him, hears the sound of his boots crunching through the snow outside her cottage. It is very quiet now. Only the popping of the fire and the hiss of the bitter wind stirring the fir trees outside her window. She is still for a moment, then she feels her body begin to convulse. Standing is no longer possible. She falls to her knees in front of the fire and begins to weep uncontrollably. Berlin, January 1944. Kurt Fogel was sleeping on the camp bed in his office when he heard a dull scraping sound that made him sit up with a start.
Who's there?
It's only me, sir.
Werner, for God's sake! You scared me to death, dragging your damned wooden leg like that. I thought it was Frankenstein coming to murder me.
I'm sorry, sir. I thought you would want to see this right away.
Ulbricht handed him a signal flimsy.
It just came in from Hamburg. A message from Catherine Blake in London.
Fogel read it quickly, heart pounding.
She's made contact with Jordan. She wants Neumann to begin making regular pickups as soon as possible. My God, Werner, she's actually done it!
Obviously, a remarkable agent, and a remarkable woman.
Yes,
Fogel said distantly.
Signal Neumann at Hampton Sands at the first opportunity. Tell him to begin pickups on the prearranged schedule.
Yes, sir.
And leave word with Admiral Canaris' office. I want to brief him on the developments first thing in the morning.
Yes, sir.
Ulbricht went out, leaving Fogel alone in the dark. He wondered how she had done it. He hoped one day she would come out so he could debrief her. Stop fooling yourself, old man. He wanted her to come out so he could see her just one more time, explain why he had treated her so horribly on the last night. It was for her own good. She couldn't see it then, but maybe, with the passing of time, she could see it now. He imagined her now. Is she frightened? Is she in danger? Of course she was in danger. She was trying to steal Allied secrets in the heart of London. One false move, and she would end up in the arms of MI5. But if there was one woman who could pull it off, it was her. Fogel had the broken heart and the broken jaw to prove it. Heinrich Himmler was working his way through a stack of paperwork at his office on Prince Albrechtstrasse when the call from Brigadefuhrer Walter Schellenberg was routed through to his desk.
"Good evening, Herr Brigadefuhrer. Or should I say good morning?"
"It's 2 a.m. I didn't think you would still be at the office."
"No rest for the weary. What can I do for you?"
"It's about the Fogel affair. I was able to convince an officer in the Abwehr communication room that it was in his interest to cooperate with us."
"Very good."
Schellenberg told Himmler about the message from Fogel's agent in London. Himmler said,
"So, your friend Horst Neumann is about to be brought into the game."
"It appears that way, Herr Reichsführer."
"I'll brief the Führer on the developments in the morning. I'm sure he'll be very pleased. This man Fogel seems to be a very capable officer. If he steals the most important secret of the war, I wouldn't be surprised if the Führer were to name him Canaris' successor."
"I can think of more worthy candidates for the job, Herr Reichsführer," Schellenberg said.
"You'd better find some way of getting control of the situation. Otherwise you might find yourself out of contention."
"Yes, Herr Reichsführer."
"You're riding with Admiral Canaris in the Tiergarten in the morning?"
"As usual."
"Perhaps you can find out something useful for a change. And do give the old fox my warmest regards. Good night, Herr Brigadefuhrer."
Himmler gently replaced the receiver in the cradle and returned to his eternal paperwork. Chapter 28. Hampton Sands, Norfolk. A grey dawn was leaking through thick clouds as Horst Neumann crossed the pine grove and climbed to the top of the dunes. The sea opened before him, grey and still in the windless morning, small breakers collapsing onto the seemingly endless expanse of beach. Neumann wore a grey tracksuit, a roll-neck sweater beneath for warmth, and a pair of soft black leather running shoes. He breathed deeply of the cold, crisp air, and then scrambled down the dunes and walked across the soft sand. The tide was going out, and there was a wide swath of hard, flat sand, perfect for running. He stretched his legs, blew on his hands, and set out at an easy pace. Terns and gulls squawked in protest and moved away. He had received a message from Hamburg earlier that morning, instructing him to begin regular pickups of material from Catherine Blake in London. It was to be done on the schedule Kurt Fogel had given him at the farm outside Berlin. The material was to be placed through a doorway in Cavendish Square, where it would be collected by a man from the Portuguese embassy and sent to Lisbon inside the diplomatic pouch. It sounded simple, but Neumann understood that courier work on the streets of London would take him straight into the teeth of the British security forces. He would be carrying information that would guarantee him a trip to the gallows if he was arrested. In combat, he always knew where the enemy was. In espionage work, the enemy could be anywhere. He could be in the next seat in a cafe or on a bus, and Neumann might never know. It took several minutes for Neumann to feel warm and for the first beads of sweat to appear on his forehead. The running worked its magic, the same magic it had worked on him since he was a boy. He was taken with a pleasant floating sensation, almost flight. His breathing was regular and relaxed, and he could feel the tension melting out of his body. He picked out an imaginary finish line about half a mile down the beach and increased his pace. The first quarter mile was good. He glided along the beach, his long stride eating up the ground, shoulders and arms loose and relaxed. The last quarter mile was tougher. Neumann's breath grew harsh and ragged. The cold air tore at his throat. His arms felt as though he were carrying lead weights. His imaginary finish line loomed 200 yards ahead. The backs of his thighs tightened suddenly, and his stride shortened. He pretended it was the home stretch of the 1500-meter final of the Olympic Games. The games I missed because I was sent off to kill Poles and Russians and Greeks and French. He imagined there was just one man in front of him, and he was gaining ground excruciatingly slowly. The finish line was 50 yards away. It was a clump of seagrass, stranded by the high tide, but in Neumann's imagination it was a real finish line with a tape and men in white jackets with stopwatches and the Olympic banner flapping over the stadium in a gentle breeze. He pounded his feet savagely against the hard sand and leaned across the sea grass, stumbled to a halt, and struggled to catch his breath. It was a silly game, a game he had played with himself since he was a child, but it served a purpose. He had proved to himself that he was finally fit again. It had taken him months to recover from the beating he suffered at the hands of the SS men, but he had finally done it. He felt he was physically ready for anything he might be confronted with. Neumann walked for a moment before breaking into a light jog. It was then that he noticed Jenny Colville, watching him from atop the dunes. Neumann smiled at her as she approached. She was more attractive than he remembered. A wide, mobile mouth, eyes large and blue, her pale complexion flushed from the morning cold. She wore a heavy wool sweater, a woolen cap, an oilskin coat, trousers haphazardly tucked inside Wellington boots. Behind her, beyond the dunes, Neumann could see white smoke from a doused fire drifting through the pine trees. Jenny drew nearer. She looked tired, and her clothes appeared slept in. Yet she smiled with considerable charm as she stood, arms akimbo, and examined him.
"Very impressive, Mr. Porter," she said.
Neumann always found her broad, sing-song Norfolk accent difficult to comprehend.
"If I didn't know better, I'd say you were in training for something."
"Old habits are hard to break. Besides, it's good for the body and the soul. You should try it sometime. It would take those extra pounds off you."
"Ah," she pushed him playfully, "I'm too skinny as it is now. All the boys in the village say so. They like Eleanor Kerrick because she has big, well, you know. She goes down to the beach with them, and they give her money to unbutton her blouse."
"I saw her in the village yesterday," Neumann said.
"She's a fat cow. You're twice as pretty as Eleanor Kerrick." "You think so?"
"I do indeed." Neumann rubbed his arms briskly and stamped his feet. "I need to walk, otherwise I'm going to be stiff as a board."
"Would you like some company?"
Neumann nodded. It was not the truth, but Neumann saw no harm in it. Jenny Colville had a terrible schoolgirl crush on him. It was obvious. She made up some excuse to drop by the Doherty cottage every day and never turned down an invitation from Mary to stay for tea or supper. Neumann had tried to pay an appropriate amount of attention to Jenny and carefully avoided putting himself in any situation where he might be alone with her. Until now. He would try to turn the conversation to his advantage, to take stock of how well his cover story was holding up in the village. They walked in silence, Jenny staring out at the sea. Neumann grabbed up a handful of stones and skipped them across the waves. Jenny said,
"Do you mind talking about the war?"
"Of course not."
"Your wounds, were they bad?"
"Bad enough to cut short my fighting days and give me a one-way ticket home."
"Where were you wounded?"
"In the head. Some day, when I know you better, I'll lift up my hair and show the scars." She looked at him and smiled.
"Your head looks fine to me."
"And what do you mean by that, Jenny Colville?"
"It means you're a handsome man, and you're smart, too, I can tell."
The wind blew a strand of hair across Jenny's face. She tucked it back under her woolen cap with a brush of her hand.
"I just don't understand what you're doing in a place like Hampton Sands."
So his cover story had aroused suspicion in the village. "I needed a place to rest and get well. The Dohertys offered to let me come here and stay with them, and I took them up on it."
"Why don't I believe that story?"
"You should, Jenny. It's the truth."
"My father thinks you're a criminal or a terrorist. He says Sean used to be a member of the IRA. Jenny, can you really picture Sean Doherty as a member of the Irish Republican Army? Besides, your father has serious problems of his own.
Jenny's face darkened. She stopped walking and turned to face him.
And what's that supposed to mean?
Neumann feared he had taken it too far. Perhaps it was better to disengage, make an excuse, and change the subject. But something made him want to finish what he started. He thought, why can't I keep my mouth shut and walk away from this? He knew the answer, of course. His own stepfather had been a vicious bastard, quick with a backhand across the face or a cruel remark that brought tears to his eyes. He felt certain Jenny Colville had endured worse physical abuse than he ever had. He wanted to say something to her that would let her know that things did not always have to be this way. He wanted to tell her she was not alone. He wanted to help her. It means he drinks far too much. Neumann reached out and touched her face gently. And it means he mistreats a beautiful, intelligent young girl who's done absolutely nothing in the world to deserve it.
Do you mean that?
She asked.
Mean what? That I'm beautiful and intelligent. No one's ever said that to me before.
Of course I mean it. She took his hand and they walked some more.
Do you have a girl?
She asked him.
No. Why not?
Why not indeed? The war. It was the easy answer. He had never had time for a girl, really. His life had been one long series of obsessions. An obsession to lose his Englishness and become a good German. An obsession to become an Olympic champion. An obsession to become the most decorated member of the Fallschirmjäger. His last lover had been a French farm girl from the village near his listening post. She had been tender when Neumann was in desperate need of tenderness, and each night, for a month, she let him in the back door of her cottage and took him secretly to her bed. When he closed his eyes, Neumann could still see her body rising to his in the flickering candlelight of her bedroom. She had taken a vow to kiss his head every night until it healed. In the end, Neumann was overcome with the guilt of an occupier and broke it off. He feared now what would happen to her when the war was over.
Your face became sad for a moment, Jenny said.
I was thinking about something.
I'd say you were thinking about someone. And by the look on your face, that someone was a woman.
You're a very perceptive girl.
Was she pretty?
She was French, and she was very beautiful.
Did she break your heart?
You might say that.
But you left her.
Yes, I suppose I did.
Why?
Because I loved her too much.
I don't understand.
You will some day.
And what do you mean by that?
It means you're far too young to be hanging around with the likes of me. I'm going to finish my run. I suggest you go home and change into some clean clothes. You look like you've been sleeping on the beach all night. They looked at each other in a way that said they both knew it was the truth. She turned to leave, then stopped.
You'd never do anything to hurt me, would you, James?
Of course not.
You promise?
I promise. She stepped forward and kissed him on the mouth very briefly before turning and running across the sand. Neumann shook his head. Then he turned in the opposite direction and ran back down the beach.
Chapter 29. London. Alfred Vickery felt he was sinking in quicksand. The more he struggled, the deeper he descended. Each time he unearthed a new clue or lead, he seemed to fall farther behind. He was beginning to doubt his chances of ever catching the spies. The source of his despair was a pair of decoded German messages that had arrived from Bletchley Park that morning. The first message was from a German agent in Britain asking Berlin to begin making regular pickups. The second was from Hamburg to a German agent in Britain asking the agent to do just that. It was a disaster. The German operation, whatever it might be, appeared to be succeeding. If the agent had requested a courier, it was logical the agent had stolen something. Vickery was struck by the fear that if he ever did catch up with the spies, he might be too late. The red light shone over Boothby's door. Vickery pressed the buzzer and waited. A minute passed, and the light still was red. So like Boothby to demand an urgent meeting, then keep his victim waiting.
"Why haven't you told us this before?"
"But I have, Alfred, old man. I told Boothby."
Vickery pressed the buzzer again. Was it really possible Boothby had known of the existence of the Fogel network and kept it from him? It made absolutely no sense. Vickery could think of only one possible explanation. Boothby had vehemently opposed Vickery's being assigned to the case and had made that clear from the outset. But would Boothby's opposition include actively trying to sabotage Vickery's efforts? Quite possible. If Vickery could display no momentum in solving the case, Boothby might have grounds to sack him and give the case to someone else, someone he trusted, a career officer perhaps, not one of the new recruits that Boothby so detested.
The light finally shone green. Vickery, slipping through the grand double doors, vowed not to leave again without first clearing the air. Boothby was seated behind his desk.
"Let's have it, Alfred!"
Vickery briefed Boothby on the content of the two messages and his theory about what they meant. Boothby listened, fidgeting and squirming in his chair.
"For God's sake!" he snapped. "The news gets worse every day with this case!"
Vickery thought, "Another sparkling contribution, Sir Basil."
"We've made some progress on piecing together background on the female agent. Carl Becker identified her as Anna von Steiner. She was born in Guy's Hospital in London on Christmas Day, 1910. Her father was Peter von Steiner, a diplomat and a wealthy West Prussian aristocrat. Her mother was an Englishwoman named Daphne Harrison. The family remained in London until war broke out, then moved to Germany. Because of Steiner's position, Daphne Harrison was not interned during the war, as many British citizens were. She died of tuberculosis in 1918 at the Steiner estate in West Prussia. After the war, Steiner and his daughter drifted from posting to posting, including another brief stint in London in the early 20s. Steiner also worked in Rome and in Washington.
"Sounds like he was a spy to me," Boothby said. "But go on, Alfred."
"In 1937, Anna Steiner vanished. We can only speculate after that. She undergoes Abwehr training, is sent to the Netherlands to establish a false identity as Christa Kunst, then enters England. By the way, Anna Steiner was allegedly killed in an auto accident outside Berlin in March 1938. Obviously, Fogel fabricated that." Boothby rose and paced his office.
"It's all very interesting, Alfred, but there's one fatal flaw. It's based on information given to you by Carl Becker. Becker would say anything to ingratiate himself."
"Becker has no reason to lie to us about this, Sir Basil, and his story is perfectly consistent with the few things we know for certain. All I'm saying, Alfred, is that I very much doubt the veracity of anything the man says."
"So why did you spend so much time with him last October?" Vickery said. Sir Basil was standing in the window, looking down at the last light slipping out of the square. His head snapped around before he regained his composure and turned slowly to face Vickery.
"The reason I spoke to Becker is none of your affair."
"Becker is my agent," Vickery said, anger creeping into his voice. "I arrested him, I turned him, I run him. He gave you information that might have proved useful to this case, yet you kept that information from me. I'd like to know why."
Boothby was very calm now.
"Becker told me the same story he told you. Special agents, a secret camp in Bavaria, special codes and rendezvous procedures. And to be honest with you, Alfred, I didn't believe him at the time. We had no other evidence to support his story. Now we do."
It was a perfectly logical explanation, on the surface at least.
"Why didn't you tell me about it?"
"It was a long time ago."
"Whose Broom?"
"Sorry, Alfred."
"I want to know who Broom is. And I'm trying to tell you, as politely as I can, that you're not entitled to know who Broom is."
Boothby shook his head.
"My God, this isn't some college club where we sit around and swap insights. This department is in the business of counterintelligence, and it operates on a very simple concept, need to know. You have no need to know who Broom is, because it does not affect any case to which you have been assigned. Therefore, it is none of your business.
Is the concept of need to know a license to deceive other officers?
I wouldn't use the word deceive, Boothby said, as though it were an obscenity. It simply means that for reasons of security, an officer is entitled to know only what is necessary for him to carry out his assignment.
How about the word lie? Would you use that word? The discussion seemed to be causing Boothby physical pain.
I suppose at times it might be necessary to be less than truthful with one officer to safeguard an operation being carried out by another. Surely this doesn't come as a surprise to you?
Of course not, Sir Basil. Vickery hesitated, deciding whether to continue with his line of questioning or disengage. I was just wondering why you lied to me about reading Kurt Fogel's file. The blood seemed to drain from Boothby's face, and Vickery could see him bunching and unbunching his big fist inside his trouser pocket. It was a risky strategy, and Grace Clarendon's neck was on the block. When Vickery was gone, Boothby would call Nicholas Jago in registry and demand answers. Jago would surely realize Grace Clarendon was the source of the leak. It was no small matter. She could be sacked immediately. But Vickery was betting they wouldn't touch Grace because it would only prove her information had been correct. He hoped to God he was right.
Looking for a scapegoat, Alfred? Someone or something to blame for your inability to solve this case? You should know the danger in that more than any of us. History is replete with examples of weak men who have found it expedient to acquire a convenient scapegoat.
Vickery thought, and you're not answering my question. He rose to his feet. Good night, Sir Basil. Boothby remained silent as Vickery walked toward the door.
There's one more thing, Boothby finally said. I shouldn't think I need to tell you this, but I shall in any case. We don't have an unlimited amount of time. If there isn't progress soon, we may have to make, well, changes. You understand, don't you, Alfred?
Chapter 30. London. As they walked into the Savoy Grill, the band began playing and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. It was a rather poor rendition, choppy and a bit rushed, but it was pretty regardless. Jordan took her hand without speaking, and they walked onto the dance floor. He was an excellent dancer, smooth and confident, and he held her very closely. He had come directly from his office and was wearing his uniform. He had brought his briefcase with him. Obviously it contained nothing important because he had left it behind at the table. Still, he never seemed to take his eyes off it for very long. After a moment, Catherine noticed something. Everyone in the room seemed to be staring at them. It was terribly unnerving. For 6 years, she had done everything in her power not to be noticed. Now she was dancing with a dazzling American naval officer at the most glamorous hotel in London. She felt exposed and vulnerable. Yet at the same time, she derived a strange satisfaction from doing something completely normal for a change. Her own appearance certainly had something to do with the attention they were drawing. She had seen it in Jordan's eyes a few minutes earlier when she walked into the bar. She looked stunning tonight. She wore a dress of black crepe material with a deep plunge in the back and a neckline that showed off the shape of her breasts. She wore her hair down, held back by a smart jeweled clasp and a double strand of pearls at her throat. She had taken care with her makeup. The wartime cosmetics were of extremely poor quality, but she didn't require much. A little lipstick to accentuate the shape of her generous mouth, a little rouge to bring out her prominent cheekbones, a bit of liner around her eyes. She derived no special satisfaction from her appearance. She had always thought of her own beauty in dispassionate terms, the way a woman might evaluate her favorite china or a cherished antique rug. Still, it had been a very long time since she had walked through a room and watched heads turn her way. She was the kind of woman that both sexes noticed. The men could hardly keep their mouths closed, The women frowned with envy. Jordan said, "Have you noticed that everyone in this room is staring at us?"
"I've noticed that, yes. Do you mind?"
"Of course not." He drew away a few inches so he could look at her face. "It's been a very long time since I've felt this way, Catherine. And to think I had to come all the way to London to find you."
"I'm glad you did."
"Can I make a confession?"
"Of course you can."
"I didn't get much sleep after you left last night." She smiled and drew him near, so her mouth was next to his ear.
"I'll make a confession, too. I didn't sleep at all."
"What were you thinking about?"
"You tell me first."
"I was thinking how much I wished you hadn't left."
"I was having very similar thoughts."
"I was thinking about kissing you."
"I think I was kissing you."
"I don't want you to leave tonight."
"I think you would have to throw me out bodily if you wanted me to leave."
"I don't think you need worry about that."
"I think I'd like you to kiss me again right now, Peter."
"What about all these people staring at us? What do you think they'll do if I kiss you?"
"I'm not sure. But it's 1944 in London. Anything can happen."
"Compliments of the gentleman at the bar," the waiter said, opening a bottle of champagne as they came back to the table.
"Does the gentleman have a name?" Jordan asked.
"None that he gave, sir."
"What did he look like?"
"Rather like a sunburned rugby player, sir."
"American naval officer?"
"Yes, sir."
"Shepherd Ramsay."
"The gentleman wishes to join you for a glass."
"Tell the gentleman thank you for the champagne, but forget it."
"Of course, sir."
"Who's Shepherd Ramsay?" Catherine asked when the waiter left.
"Shepherd Ramsay is my oldest and dearest friend in the world. I love him like a brother."
"So why don't you let him come over for a drink?"
"Because for once in my adult life, I'd like to do something without him. Besides, I don't want to share you."
"Good, because I don't want to share you either."
Catherine raised her champagne glass.
"To the absence of Shepherd."
Jordan laughed. "To the absence of Shepherd." They touched glasses. Catherine added,
"And to the blackout, without which I would never have bumped into you."
"To the blackout." Jordan hesitated. "I know this probably sounds like a terrible cliché, but I can't take my eyes off of you." Catherine smiled and leaned across the table.
"I don't want you to take your eyes off me, Peter. Why do you think I wore this dress?"
"I'm a little nervous."
"I am too, Peter.
You look so beautiful lying there in the moonlight."
"You look beautiful, too."
"Don't. My wife..."
"I'm sorry. It's just that I've never seen a man who looked quite like you. Try not to think about your wife for just a few minutes."
"It's very hard. But you're making it a little easier."
"You look like a statue, kneeling there like that."
"A very old, crumbling statue."
"A beautiful statue. I can't stop touching you."
"Touching them. They're so beautiful. I've been dreaming of touching them like this since the first moment I saw you."
"You can touch them harder. It won't hurt."
"Like this?"
"Oh, God. Yes, Peter, just like that. But I want to touch you, too."
"That feels so nice when you do that."
"It does?" "Ah, yes, it does. It's so hard. It feels wonderful. There's something else I want you to do to it."
"What?"
"I can't say it out loud. Just come closer."
"Catherine."
"Just do it, darling. I promise you won't regret it." "Oh, my God, that feels so incredible." "Then I shouldn't stop?" "You look so beautiful doing that." "I want to make you feel good."
"I want to make you feel good."
"I can show you how."
"I think I know how."
"Oh, Peter, your tongue feels so wonderful. Oh, please touch my breasts while you do that."
"I want to be inside you."
"Hurry, Peter. Oh, you're so soft, so wonderful.
Oh, God, Catherine, I'm going to..."
"Wait, not yet, darling. Do me a favor and lie down on your back. Let me do the rest."
He did as she asked. She took him in her hand and guided him inside her body. She could have just lain there and let him finish, but she wanted it this way. She always knew Fogel would do this to her. Why else would he want a female agent except to seduce Allied officers and steal their secrets? She always thought the man would be fat and hairy and old and ugly, not like Peter. If she was going to be Kurt Fogel's whore, she might as well enjoy it. Oh, God, Catherine, you shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be losing control like this. But she couldn't help it. She was enjoying it, and she was losing control. Her head rolled back, and her hands went to her breasts, and she stroked her nipples with her fingers, and after a moment she felt his warm release within her, and it washed over her in wave after wonderful wave. It was late, at least 4 o'clock, though Catherine couldn't be sure, because it was too dark to see the clock on the bedstand. It didn't matter. All that mattered was that Peter Jordan was sleeping soundly next to her. His breathing was deep and regular. They had eaten a large meal, had a lot to drink, and made love twice. Unless he was a very light sleeper, he would probably sleep through a Luftwaffe night raid right now. She slipped out of bed, put on the silk dressing robe he had given her, and padded quietly across the room. The bedroom door was closed halfway. Catherine opened it a few inches, slipped through the doorway, and closed it behind her. The silence rang in her ears. She could feel her heart pounding in her chest. She forced herself to be calm. She had worked too hard, risked too much just to get to this point. One silly mistake, and it would destroy all she had done. She moved quickly down the narrow staircase. The stair creaked. She froze, waiting to hear if Jordan woke up. Outside, a car whooshed through standing water. Somewhere, a dog was barking. In the distance, a lorry horn blared. She realized these were just the average sounds of the night that people slept through all the time. She walked quickly down the stairs and along the hall. She found his keys on a small table next to her handbag. She picked them both up and went to work. Catherine had limited objectives tonight. She wanted to guarantee herself regular access to Jordan's study and his private papers. For that, she needed her own copy of the keys to the front door, to the study door, and to his briefcase. Jordan's key ring held several keys. The key to the front door was obvious. It was larger than the rest. She reached in her purse and removed a block of soft brown clay. She singled out the skeleton key and pressed it into the clay, making a neat imprint. The key to the briefcase was also obvious. It was the smallest. She repeated the same process, making another neat imprint. The study would be more difficult. There were a number of keys that looked as though they might be the one. There was only one way to find out which it was. She picked up her handbag and Jordan's briefcase, carried everything down the hall to the study door, and began trying the different keys. The fourth key she tried fit the lock. She removed it and pressed it into her block of clay. Catherine could stop now, and it would be a very successful evening. She could make duplicate keys, and she could come back when Jordan wasn't home and photograph everything in his study. She would do that. But she wanted more tonight. She wanted to prove to Fogel that she had done it, that she was a talented agent. By her estimate, she had been out of bed less than 2 minutes. She could afford two more. She unlocked the study door, went inside, and switched on the light. It was a handsome room, furnished like the drawing room in a masculine way. There was a large desk and a leather chair and a drafting table with a tall wooden stool in front of it. Catherine reached inside her handbag and withdrew two items, her camera and her silenced Mauser pistol. She laid the Mauser on the desk. She raised the camera to her eye and clicked off two photographs of the room. Next, she unlocked Jordan's briefcase. It was virtually empty, just a billfold, a case for eyeglasses, and a small leather-bound appointment book. She thought, it's a start, at least. Perhaps there were names of important men with whom Jordan had met. If the Abwehr knew whom he was meeting, perhaps they could discover the nature of his work. How many times had she done this at the training camp? God, but she had lost count. 100 at least, always with Fogel standing over her with his bloody stopwatch.
Too long! Too loud! Too much light! Not enough! They're coming for you! You're caught!
What do you do now?
She laid the appointment book on the desk and switched on the desk lamp. It had a pliable arm and a dome over the bulb to focus the light downward, perfect for photographing documents. 3 minutes. Work quickly now, Catherine. She opened the notebook and adjusted the lamp so the light shone directly onto the page. If she did it at the wrong angle, or if the light was too close, the negatives would be ruined. She did it just as Fogel had instructed, and started snapping off the photographs. Names, dates, short notes written in his scrawling hand. She photographed a few more pages and then found something very interesting. One page contained crude sketches of a box-like figure. There were numbers on the page that appeared to represent dimensions. Catherine photographed that page twice to make certain she captured the image. 4 minutes. One more item tonight. The safe. It was bolted to the floor next to the desk. Fogel had given her a combination that was supposed to unlock it. Catherine knelt and turned the dial. 6 digits. When she turned to the last number, she felt the tumbler settle into place. She took hold of the latch and applied pressure. The latch snapped into the open position. The combination worked. She pulled open the door and looked inside. 2 binders filled with papers, several loose-leaf notebooks. It would take hours to photograph everything. She would wait. She aimed the camera at the inside of the safe and took a photograph. 5 minutes. Time to put everything back in its original place. She closed the safe door, returned the latch to the locked position, and spun the dial. She placed the block of clay in her handbag carefully so as not to damage the imprints. The camera and the Mauser were next. She returned Jordan's appointment book to its place inside his briefcase and locked it. Then she shut off the lights and went out. She closed the door and locked it. 6 minutes. Too long. She carried everything back into the hall and placed the keys, his briefcase, and her handbag back on the table. Done. She needed an excuse. She was thirsty. It was true. Her mouth was parched from nerves. She went into the kitchen, took a glass down from the cabinet, and filled it with cold water from the tap. She drank it down immediately, refilled it, and carried the glass upstairs to the bedroom. Catherine felt relief washing over her, and at the same time an amazing sense of power and triumph. Finally, after months of training and years of waiting, she had done something. She realized suddenly that she liked spying. The satisfaction of meticulously planning and executing an operation, the childlike pleasure of knowing a secret, learning something that someone doesn't want you to know. Fogel had been right all along, of course. She was perfect for it, in every way. She opened the door and went back into the bedroom. Peter Jordan was sitting up in bed in the moonlight.
"Where have you been? I was worried about you."
"I was dying of thirst."
She couldn't believe the calm, collected voice was really hers.
"I hope you brought me some, too," he said.
"Oh, thank God."
She could breathe again.
"Of course I did."
She handed him the glass of water, and he drank it. Catherine asked,
"What time is it?"
5 o'clock. I have to be up in an hour for an 8 o'clock meeting."
She kissed him.
"So we have 1 hour left."
"Catherine, I couldn't possibly..."
"Oh, I bet you could."
She let the silk gown fall from her shoulders and drew his face to her breasts. Catherine Blake, later that morning, strode along the Chelsea embankment as a light, bitterly cold rain drifted across the river. During her preparation, Fogel had provided her with a sequence of 20 different rendezvous, each in a different location in central London, each at a slightly different time. He had forced her to commit them to memory, and she assumed he had done the same thing with Horst Neumann before sending him to England. Under the rules, it was Catherine who would decide whether the meeting would take place. If she saw anything she didn't like, a suspicious face, men in a parked car, she could call it off, and they would try again at the next location on the list at the specified time. Catherine saw nothing out of the ordinary. She glanced at her wristwatch. 2 minutes early. She continued walking and, inevitably, thought about what had happened last night. She worried she had taken things with Jordan too far, too fast. She hoped he hadn't been shocked by the things she had done to his body, or by the things she had asked him to do to hers. Perhaps a middle-class Englishwoman wouldn't have behaved like that. Too late for second thoughts now, Catherine. The morning had been like being in a dream. It felt as if she had been magically turned into someone else and dropped into their world. She dressed and made coffee while Jordan shaved and showered. The placid domestic scene felt bizarre to her. She felt a stab of fear when he unlocked the study door and went inside. Did I leave anything out of place? Does he realize I was in there last night? They had shared a taxi. During the short ride to Grosvenor Square, she was struck by another thought. What if he doesn't want to see me again? It had never occurred to her before that moment. All of it would have been for nothing unless he truly cared for her. Her concerns had been groundless. As the taxi arrived at Grosvenor Square, he asked her to have dinner with him that evening at an Italian restaurant in Charlotte Street. Catherine turned around and retraced her steps along the embankment. Neumann was there now, walking toward her. Hands plunged into the pockets of his reefer coat, collar up against the rain, slouch hat pulled down close to his eyes. He had a good look for a field agent, small, anonymous, yet vaguely menacing. Put a suit on him, and he could attend a Belgravia cocktail party. Dressed as he was now, he could walk the toughest docks in London, and no one would dare look at him twice. She wondered if he had ever studied acting, like she had. "You look like you could use a cup of coffee," he said. "There's a nice warm café not too far from here." Neumann held out an arm to her. She took it, and they strolled along the embankment. It was very cold. She gave him the film, and he carelessly dropped it into his pocket, as though it were spare change. Fogel had trained him well. Catherine said, "You know where to deliver this, I assume?" "Cavendish Square. A man from the Portuguese embassy named Hernandez will pick it up at 3 o'clock this afternoon and place it in the diplomatic pouch. It will go to Lisbon tonight and be in Berlin in the morning."
"Very good.
What is it, by the way?"
"His appointment book, some photographs of his study. Not much, but it's a start."
"Very impressive," Neumann said. "How did you get it?"
"I let him take me to dinner. Then I let him take me to bed. I got up in the middle of the night and slipped into his study. The combination worked, by the way. I also saw the inside of his safe."
Neumann shook his head. "That's risky as hell. If he comes downstairs, you're in trouble."
"I know. That's why I need these."
She reached into her handbag and gave him the block of clay with the imprints of the keys.
"Find someone to make copies of these and deliver them to my flat today. Tomorrow, when he goes to work, I'm going to go back inside his house and photograph everything in that study."
Neumann pocketed the block of clay. "Right. Anything else?"
"Yes. From now on, no more conversations like this. We bump into each other. I give you the film, you walk away and deliver it to the Portuguese. If you have a message for me, write it down and give it to me. Understood?"
"Understood." They stopped walking.
"Well, you have a very busy day ahead of you, Mr. Porter."
She kissed his cheek and said into his ear,
"I risked my life for those things. Don't fuck it up now."
Then she turned and walked away down the embankment. The first problem confronting Horst Neumann that morning was finding someone to make copies of Peter Jordan's keys. No reputable shop in the West End would make a duplicate key based on an imprint. In fact, they would probably call the Metropolitan Police and have him arrested. He needed to go to a neighborhood where he might find a shopkeeper willing to do the job for the right price. He walked along the Thames, crossed Battersea Bridge, and headed into South London. It didn't take Neumann long to find what he was looking for. The shop's windows had been blown out by a bomb. Now they were boarded up with plywood. Neumann stepped inside. There were no customers, just an older man behind the counter wearing a heavy blue shirt and a grimy apron. Neumann said, "You make keys, mate?" The clerk inclined his head toward the grinder. Neumann took the clay from his pocket. "You know how to make keys from something like this?"
"Yep, but it will cost you."
"How's 10 shillings sound?" The clerk smiled. He had about half his teeth.
"Sounds like sweet music."
He took the clay.
"Be ready by tomorrow noon."
I need them right now.
The clerk was smiling his horrid smile again.
Well now, that's going to cost you another 10 bob.
Neumann laid the money on the counter. I'll wait here while you cut them, if you don't mind.
Suit yourself.
In the afternoon, the rain stopped. Neumann walked a great deal. When he wasn't walking, he was jumping on and off buses and rushing in and out of the underground. He had only the vaguest memories of London from when he was a boy, and he actually enjoyed spending the day in the city. It was a relief from the boredom of Hampton Sands. Nothing to do there except run on the beach and read and help Sean in the meadows with the sheep. Leaving the hardware shop, he pocketed the duplicate keys and recrossed Battersea Bridge. He took Catherine's block of clay, crushed it so as to erase the imprints, and tossed it into the Thames. It broke the surface with a deep bloop and vanished into the swirling water. He meandered through Chelsea and Kensington and finally into Earl's Court. He placed the keys in an envelope and the envelope through Catherine's letterbox. Then he took his lunch at a window table of a crowded café. A woman 2 tables away made eyes at him throughout the meal, but he had brought a newspaper for protection and looked up only occasionally to smile at her. It was tempting. She was attractive enough, and it might be an enjoyable way to kill the rest of the afternoon and get off the streets for a while. It was insecure, however. He paid his bill, winked at her, and walked out. 15 minutes later, he stopped at a phone box, picked up the receiver, and dialed a local number. It was answered by a man who spoke heavily accented English. Neumann politely asked for a Mr. Smythe. The fellow at the other end of the line protested a little too vehemently that there was no one named Smythe at this number. Then he violently rang off. Neumann smiled and returned the receiver to its cradle. The exchange was a crude code. The man was the Portuguese courier, Carlos Hernandez. When Neumann called and asked for someone with a name beginning with an S, the courier was to go to Cavendish Square and collect the material. He still had an hour to kill. He walked in Kensington, skirting Hyde Park, and arrived at Marble Arch. The clouds thickened and it started to rain. Just a few cold, fat drops to begin with, then a steady downpour. He ducked into a bookshop in a small street off Portman Square. He browsed for a bit, dismissing an offer of assistance from the dark-haired girl standing atop a ladder stocking books on the top shelves. He selected a volume of T.S. Eliot and a new novel by Graham Greene called The Ministry of Fear. While he was paying, the girl professed love for Eliot and invited Neumann for coffee when she took her break at 4 o'clock. He declined, but said he was frequently in the area and would come back. The girl smiled, placed the books in a brown paper bag, and said she would like that. Neumann walked out, accompanied by the tinkle of the little bell attached to the top of the door. He arrived in Cavendish Square. The rain diminished to a chilly drizzle. It was too cold for him to wait on a bench in the square, so he walked around it several times, never taking his eye from the doorway on the southwest corner. After 20 minutes of this, the fat man arrived. He wore a grey suit, grey overcoat, and bowler hat and carried himself as though he were about to rob a bank. He shoved his key in the door as though he were entering enemy territory and went inside. When the door closed, Neumann crossed the square, removed the film from his jacket pocket, and dropped it through the mail slot. On the other side of the door he heard the fat man grunting as he stooped to pick it up. Neumann walked away and continued his tour of the square, again never taking his eyes from the house. The Portuguese diplomat emerged 5 minutes later, found a taxi after a moment, and was gone. Neumann looked at his wristwatch, more than an hour before his train. He thought about going back to the bookshop for the girl. The idea of coffee and intelligent conversation appealed to him. But even innocent discourse was a potential minefield. Speaking the language and understanding the culture were 2 different things. He might make a stupid remark, and she might become suspicious. It was not worth the risk. He left Cavendish Square, books beneath his arm, and took the underground east to Liverpool Street, where he boarded the late afternoon train for Hunstanton. Part 3. Chapter 31. Berlin, February 1944. It's called Operation Mulberry, Admiral Canaris began. And as of now, we don't have the slightest idea what it's all about. A smile flickered across Brigadefuhrer Walter Schellenberg's lips and evaporated as quickly as summer rain. When the two men had ridden together earlier that morning in the Tiergarten, Canaris had not told Schellenberg the news. Catching a glimpse of Schellenberg's reaction now, Canaris felt no guilt about keeping it from the young general. Their horseback meetings had one unspoken ground rule. Each man was expected to use them for his own advantage. Canaris decided to share or withhold information based on a simple formula. Did it help his cause? Outright lying was frowned upon. Lying led to reprisals, and reprisals spoiled the affable atmosphere of the rides. A few days ago, the Luftwaffe shot these surveillance photographs. Canaris laid two enlargements on the low, ornate coffee table around which they were seated. This is Selsea Bill in the south of England. We are almost certain these work sites are connected to the project. Canaris used a silver pen as a pointer. Obviously something very large is being hastily constructed at these sites. There are huge stockpiles of cement and steel girding. In this photograph, a scaffolding is visible.
Impressive, Admiral Canaris, Hitler said. What else do you know?
We know that several top-flight British and American engineers are working on the project. We also know that General Eisenhower is intimately involved. Unfortunately, we are missing one very important piece of the puzzle, the purpose of the giant concrete structures. Canaris paused for a moment. Find that missing piece, and we may very well solve the puzzle of the Allied invasion. Hitler was visibly impressed with Canaris's briefing.
I have just one more question, Herr Admiral, Hitler said. The source of your information. What is it?
Canaris hesitated. Himmler's face twitched. Then he said, Surely, Admiral Canaris, you don't think anything said here this morning would go beyond this room? Of course not, Herr Reichsführer. One of our agents in London is getting the information directly from a senior member of the Mulberry team. The source of the leak does not know he has been compromised. According to Brigadefuhrer Schellenberg's sources, British intelligence knows about our operation but has been unable to stop it.
This is true, Schellenberg said. I have it from an excellent source that MI5 is operating in crisis mode.
Ah, well, isn't this refreshing? The SD and the Abwehr working together for a change instead of clawing at each other's throats. Perhaps this is a sign of good things to come.
Hitler turned to Canaris.
Perhaps Brigadefuhrer Schellenberg can help you unlock the riddle of those concrete boxes.
Schellenberg smiled and said,
My thoughts, precisely.